The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
I'm from St. Xavier's College. My question to you is, what is your take or opinion about jihad or jihadi, whatever is your opinion? Like, what do you think of them?
The phrase jihad has a lot of meanings within Islam and is subject to a lot of different interpretations. But I will say that first, Islam is one of the world's great religions. And the more than a billion people who practice Islam, the overwhelming majority, view their obligations to their religion as ones that reaffirm peace and justice and fairness and tolerance. I think all of us recognize that this great religion, in the hands of a few extremists, has been distorted to justify violence towards innocent people that is never justified.
Well, here we are. Double speak is not just around the corner. Double speak is everywhere. In fact, double speak is now on the corner. The only thing missing from America now are large loudspeakers on every corner with statements coming from Obama or from the TSA chief telling us how wonderful it is to be frisked and body scanned. Play the music, would you? I mean, it's a big week ahead of me. God, it's like sledging uphill now. There's no election, nothing. I have to revert back to my normal, intelligent self, thank God. Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, Fridays. I mean, we have, you know, plenty to talk about. And since we have plenty to talk about this week, we'll talk about Obama today. We will talk about the two faces of Barack Obama. That's a headline coming out of a newspaper in India entitled India Today, New Delhi. The two faces of Barack Obama. And it says, a Diwali weekend should be a perfect, if a bit noisy, break for a president in distress. Now, you must remember he's a president in distress. You must remember that this radical socialist Marxist has wrecked not only the Democrat Party, but America as well. The good news, though, I'm embroidering now. The good news, though, is that America has awakened him. We actually have to thank Obama. Because had he been a little more patient, he probably could have gotten away with it, given the let us say, naivete of the American people and the tolerance of the American people. If he had waited a little bit longer and he didn't have such a pushy woman as Nancy Pelosi, he probably could have gotten away with a lot more. But the arrogance and the power madness has awakened America to the dangers of this socialist president. And so it says, President Barack Obama batted at home, badly needs a break. The festive lights, however, might only expose a dubious policy as he winks at his wartime ally, Pakistan, with one face and smiles at his peacetime friend, India, with another. The text of his Delhi visit can be read only in the context of the Obama presidency's biggest foreign policy challenge, Pakistan and Afghanistan. Obama prepared for Delhi by giving Pakistan $2 billion, which means a fresh warehouse of arms. Islamabad is likely to use the money to buy more advanced F-16 fighter aircraft and helicopter gunships. India and the U.S. should be natural allies. Obama's predecessor, which means Bush, whose worldview was conditioned by a biblical sense of good and evil, recognized India as special. The Indo-U.S. nuclear pact was the strategic culmination of his ideological investment, built on the foundation laid by Jaswant Singh Strobe Talbot talks. But this relationship, they say, has stagnated under Obama. Even during his campaign, Obama sent danger signals to New Delhi, India. He said in an interview to Times Joe Klein that working with Pakistan and India to resolve the Kashmir crisis in a serious way would be one of the critical tasks for the next administration. He then suggested the appointment of a special envoy for the task in Kashmir, which he described as a, you read all of this, or you don't want to hear any more. All right, you want the jokes, the sticking lips in the Indian restaurant, whatever. It's actually depressing. I read a book, 110,000 words. It sells well. And every time I run into strangers, I say, oh, are you Michael Savage? I just want to say thank you. I really like your stories about your lips sticking together in that Chinese. I got to tell you, you really cracked me up with those stories. All right, whatever keeps you listening, you know what I'm saying? But for God's sakes, speaking of which, I went into the, I'm shy of bookstores. I don't go into bookstores for a number of reasons. I haven't for many years, which is a shame. I used to, you know, I mean, a writer should live in bookstores, right? I used to love bookstores, but all right, so I stopped going. But now that I have a raging bestseller, Trickle Up Poverty, I went into to my local Barnes & Noble. I was dressed somewhat like a homeless person, which is my normal garb during the week. I bicycle, you see, and when I bicycle, I like to wear old clothing. I don't wear any kind of jester costumes. I leave that to the fools who wear jester costumes on bicycles and show you their butt as they cut you off and wave a hammer at you to break your mirror. So I wear old clothes, I mean, because they're comfortable if you fall. You know what I mean? There's a little water on the ground. I swear to God, so I have one jacket that's 20 years old that I wear. I like it. It's padded if I fall, you know, the whole. So I go in with the helmet, the glasses, the sweatshirt under the helmet. I look like, you know, the Unabomber and with sunglasses. And no one, of course, knows me, thank God, because I'm not a TV guy. And I go to the bestseller rack, and there's my book, and it was a pleasure. Over comes the manager. Under the garb, she apparently recognized me. And she says, Michael, it's so nice to see you here. I was shocked that she knew me at all. I mean, I'm a local author, but I never make it. I'm not one of these guys who reads his books and, you know, the postmenopausal crowd and all that. So she was an African-American lady, the nicest woman you could ever believe running a major league bookstore. And I wouldn't say she was a fan of the show. I didn't even ask her that. She was just a woman knowledgeable about the book business. She said, let me tell you a story. A woman came in last week into this store. And she got in my face, and she yelled at me. And she said, you put that book in that slot where it belonged. And she said it was funny, because your listeners are fanatic about this. They won't stop demanding, you know, the right placement in this and that. I thought that was pretty amazing. So anyway, big deal. So I took a picture with a cell phone camera. I had to take a picture, finally, in front of a book thing. I felt comfortable enough to go to the magazine stand. I don't know how bookstores make money, by the way. Because it's filled with deadbeats who sit there all day long reading magazines for free, and then they put them back in the rack all wrinkled up. I feel bad about it. Like, I grew up in a time, I'm even afraid to touch a magazine because it was considered cheating. When I was a kid, if you went into a candy store and you looked at a comic, the guy behind the counter would practically tear your hands off if you read it for free. You remember those days? Who would have the nerve to go into a candy store and look at, let's say, a comic book for nothing? How would you expect a guy to make a living? So it was understood that it was like a social contract. If you went into a store to look at a comic book as a kid, I was trained, my father would say, you buy it, don't read it for free. That's cheating. So I paid the nickel or the dime. Now you got people in there, mainly liberals with gray beards. They got nothing to do. They're unemployed or probably retired professors, who knows. And they sit around looking scruffier than I, reading the magazines. So today I went in and I read the magazines. I did buy a few. You know, it's funny. You can tell a man by the magazines he reads. Let me tell you what I bought. I bought Flying Magazine. I bought several boating magazines. I bought Hemmings Motor News. I bought some classic car magazine. Something, you know, like cars and stuff like that. Magazines are a lot of pleasure. They're very relaxing. In addition to being interesting, they're very relaxing. Why Flying Magazine? I don't fly. I've always wanted to be a pilot. I can't fly. I don't have the skill for it. I can boat. I mean, I drive a 40-ton boat without any water, but I can't fly a plane. I'm thinking of taking up flying lessons now at my age. Who knows? Why not? I mean, a lot of people do it. I mean, when you think about it, I'd rather die in a plane crash than die of cancer or a heart attack. Symbol shot. Have you thought about that? I mean, do you really want to sit and wait to go to the assisted living with the teeth falling out? And have an illegal immigrant beat you up for your small change when your family leaves you there in the last years of your life as they push you into a corner facing an old curtain and you can't move. It's a horrible way to die. They beat you about the head and neck and, you know, take your money. It's worse than a TSA agent. What happens to the old people in assisted living is worse than what happens in an airport screening today. So there you are, 1-800-5... Oh, play clip 21. That's interesting. That's a good one. This is a very good
one. So we're walking through security in Denver Airport, and they make you take off your shoes and put everything on the conveyor belt. And after you take off your shoes and put everything on the scanner, they have you walk through a metal detector. Well, after they have you walk through a metal detector, they want you to go to the naked body scanner. Well, I was told here to say I opt out. And so I said, I opt out for me and my children. And so they yelled real loud, we have an opt out. And
opt
so they
out.
Pulled us off to the side, and they start at your ankle, and they work their way up with hands on both sides of your legs. Mm-hmm. They get to your private area. They, you know, feel your private area, work their way down to your other leg.
Now, I want to say this. These degenerates in the TSA business, if they did that on the street, they'd go to jail for 20 years for rape or whatever it's called. But they get away with it because Big Sis gives them the license to frisk your wife. I told you now for weeks. This is outrageous. How does it relate to Obama? It directly relates to Obama. It's all part of the government plan to break you down, to weaken you, to permit them to do anything they want. If you're willing to suffer any indignity whatsoever from a TSA agent now, what's going to happen is they're going to take more and more liberties with you because we have evil people at the top of the food chain. How many times do I have to tell you that? A civil society needs civil leadership. We don't have civil leadership. We have naked Marxists, and we have thugs. And I'll be right back.
Savage.
So there are a lot of reports now of people who are getting furious at the superb individual at the head of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, a superb individual, unleashing an army of perverts to frisk women, grabbing breasts, crotches. I told you, I mean, I don't fly for that reason. All the people I've sought to avoid my entire life by succeeding in life where I wouldn't have to be around them, I moved away from them. I mean, you want to be clear about it? You want me to be... See, here's why people love me and why they hate me. Because I tell you the truth. Why would a person struggle their entire life to move to a better neighborhood? To get away from people like those who work for the TSA, for example. I don't want to live in their neighborhood. So all of the gangbangers who can't get jobs, they give them jobs at the TSA, mixed in with the others. And they treat you like you're a prisoner. I hate it. I hate it. I resent it. I don't like having a gangbanger running his hands into my crotch, if you don't mind. So I don't fly anymore. That's one of the reasons I hate flying. Okay, that's number one. But for women to have to put up with this crap. I mean, Barack Obama and Michelle or Nancy Pelosi, they don't get frisked at the airport, do they? No, I tell you it's okay for you, for your security, that's all. Okay, I'm not going to talk much more about it. I'm going to take callers. Dallas, Texas, Pete, you're on the Savage Nation.
Michael, it's no wonder why your book, TUP, is being blacklisted by the conservative media. For one, Rush Limbaugh stole the term the day after you invented it. The wallbanger and the leprechaun, they use the word Islamo-fascist on a daily basis. Everybody stole the word compassionate conservative. If you get on TV for even a minute and start talking, everyone's going to realize instantly that you are the innovator of conservative modern media, and the rest of them are just a bunch of... ex-record-spinning hacks.
Well, you know, I don't have to run them all down because you've done it for me, so thank you. This way I can look like I'm above it. But thank you for speaking to me. But I want to say this. It's a big world. There's a lot of airtime to fill, and we need a lot of airheads to fill it. That's number one. If some of them want to wrap themselves in the flag in order to make a buck, that's terrific. As far as stealing phrases without alliteration, fine. I mean, that's standard. But it's been said that it's the mark of excellence. In other words, the more things that people rip off from you, you know what I'm saying? That's how you define leadership. So let them rip off to their heart's content. I understand the difference. I've listened to people speak. I hear a wall banger going ham and haw. You can almost predict what they're going to say before they say it because they use pat phrases. I know that. But I don't mind them. They're like students I had when I was a teacher in high school. When I was a high school teacher, there were smart kids and there weren't smart kids. So what are you going to do? Look, as I say, it's a big world. I don't need to knock them. And I'm glad that you noted that the wall banger and the others are known for their great intellect. Now, what I want to talk about is the fact that there's very little that you're interested in right now. I know this. See, I got to talk to you quietly now. Everything's different. In fact, I'm tempted now to go get the four magazines I bought. Boating, flying. I didn't get a gun magazine. Boating, flying, Hemmings Motor News. I could talk with you. I can guarantee you if I brought down Hemmings Motor News into the studio now, and I went through cars that I'm thinking of buying, like a 56 Caddy or whatever like that, I guarantee you'd be as interested as you are about Obama's trip to India, if not more so. Because it's coming out of your ears. But the fact is that there's an old rule in radio, which I'm not going to tell you because the lesser lights will steal it. But I know all the rules in radio. I didn't write them, but believe me, I learned very well. And it has a lot to do with the energy and the interest level of the host. I'm not that interested in politics right now. Yes, I am to an extent when it comes to an individual as harebrained as Nancy Pelosi. Here is a woman who wrecked her own party. Here is a woman who actually, I pray to God, she does fight to retain leadership because she's the best thing in the world for the conservative movement. I mean, without Nancy Pelosi, we wouldn't have had that victory last week. Remember that. She single-handedly gave us 60 seats in the House of Representatives. So I pray to God that she fights to hold on. We don't want a moderate person in the House of Representatives from the Democrat side. We want to give the American people a clear choice between Americans and Democrats, because that's how I see it. I know that that's not the normal dividing line, but to me there's two parties, a party for America, somewhat liberal, somewhat conservative, called the Republicans, and then the Democrats, who are a party for international socialism. Why do I say it? Because Barack Obama is a Marxist-Leninist, and his hard left march towards socialism, his spread the wealth around nonsense, his disregard for our Constitution must be stopped. And it has been paused. It has been put on pause. But you know what you can do with a pause button, don't you? They can take this lame duck session and press the pause button, and it'll start running again on a fast track to Karl Marx. You understand this? So don't go to sleep so fast.
Savage.
The aftershocks of the record Republican gains in Congress are being felt throughout the nation. Joining us on the phone is one of the nation's top radio talk show hosts, Michael Savage. His new book, Trickle Up Poverty, Stopping Obama's Attack on Our Borders, Economy and Security, went to number one on the Amazon bestsellers list. Welcome back to Newsmax TV, Michael.
Hey, thank you very much. Newsmax, I think, had a lot to do with the jump because this is one of the few outlets that I'm permitted to speak on. I'm banned in Britain and banned on ABC, CBS, and NBC, so it's always fun. But let's focus, as I know you want to, on the astonishing election.
Sure. In your opinion, why is it that Democrats lost so big in the midterms?
Well, I guess we could make it simple and say it's the economy, stupid, and that's a quote, but that's not all it was. People are trying to say it's the Obamacare and the spending. And I'm sure both of those elements are true. To me, by what I have heard on my show, it is all about Obama and his far-left agenda. It's all about saying to him, stop it, we're not going there, you're not dragging America into a socialist state. That's what I see happening. And I don't think I'm alone in that observation.
Now, President Obama gave a post-election speech. Is he sincere in saying that he is ready to work with Republicans?
I think that the proof is in his actions. The man is leaving on Saturday, on this weekend, for a trip to India that will allegedly cost $200 million a day. The reports are coming out that he has commandeered 32 American warships offshore, that they're building a tunnel so he can visit a certain site. Is this a royal presidency? Let's put it another way. Is this a president who hears the American people saying, stop the spending? Is this a president who one day says, I understand that people are hurting out there, and the next day takes a $200 million a day junket with 3,000 people in his entourage? I don't think he's heard a word anyone said to him.
How can the White House possibly rationalize that expense?
I don't know. I have no idea. They're denying it. Their rationalization is that it's not happening. They're saying those numbers are greatly inflated, but they won't produce numbers, they say, for security reasons. that classic cover-up, isn't it? But newspapers in India are reporting the figure of $200 billion, and the number of ships, 32 ships, is being reported, and the digging of a tunnel a kilometer long that is bomb-proof for him to visit a certain tourist site. It's astounding. It's a stunning thing to look at all of this royalist behavior.
Michael, let's talk a little bit more about the election. You're in California. What a Republican disaster. How did Meg Whitman for governor and Carly Fiorina for Senate go so wrong?
Well, you talk about poverty and trickle-up poverty. Here's a woman who spent $140 million of her own money. So she ran as a rich woman. Fiorina ran as a rich woman. It's an anomaly to consider them sort of reflections of the Tea Party, because they weren't. So far as I know, neither of these candidates in California had the backing of any major Tea Party action. And the conservative base was not excited by either of them, precisely because these two ladies stood for nothing but themselves. All of her ads said, vote for Meg. Give Meg a chance. Don't vote for Jerry Brown. None of them said, we will stop the flood of illegal aliens. We will address the concerns that Democrats and Republicans alike want addressed. It was all about them. It was all about ego. So that was number one. They ran the wrong campaign. Secondly, the demographics of California are very different than most of America, in that we are flooded with illegal aliens, most of whom vote, because there's no photo ID required. And that is how this far-left government continues to roll on.
Now, many of Sarah Palin's Tea Party endorsements fared very well in this election. She's just released a post-election ad evoking the spirit of Ronald Reagan.
She can pretty much, she's a kingmaker, to her credit. And that's good in the sense that her politics are very good for America. The only question I have is, will the Republicans give a darn?
Do you think an ad like this, in which she in effect says that it's a brand new day for America, do you think that this could be the very first campaign ad for Sarah Palin for 2012?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't any idea what she's thinking. She's very ambitious. She's very successful. Let's wait and see.
Who do you support for president in 2012?
At this time, someone who's not running, Jim DeMint.
What do you think he brings to the table, or what is it about him specifically that you like?
Well, for one, he was working the conservative beat when it was completely unpopular. He was rejected by his own party for being too conservative. He's now come out as a big kingmaker in the legislative elements of things. He's also a great gentleman. He's a fine speaker. He speaks very in a measured tone and very, very directly, but also very quietly. I think he's very electable. I don't know whether he wants to run. I'll tell you who would be a great vice presidential candidate with him. An African-American gentleman named Colonel Allen West out of Florida, who just won Congress despite all odds, despite smear campaigns. What a ticket that would be, DeMint and West. I think they could win easily.
All right. And you think they have what it takes to beat Obama then? Or, say, Hillary Clinton or Kucinich?
Well, now that's another story. Hillary Clinton is a formidable opponent. I'm not so sure that the Republicans could easily beat her if they're going to run Sarah Palin, because they're going to take her experience, that is Hillary's experience, and they're going to use it against anyone the Republicans run. And that is a real challenge for the Republican Party.
All right, well, let's talk about some of the issues. In your view, should Obamacare be repealed? I know that's been a big priority for Republicans.
I spend an entire chapter in Trickle-Up Poverty describing the Frankenstein of Obamacare. Few people know what's actually in the bill. I spent months reading the bill. I digest it, absorb it, and I warn America, they've seen nothing yet. They absolutely have to study it themselves and make up their own minds. Obamacare is worse than Cuban medical care. Everyone loses. The only winners are the special interests who will be running both the insurance business, the medical business, and the supply business. The measured care for people will give seniors less care, and the costs will go through the ceiling. And the type of doctor we're going to get is not going to be on par with what we are used to.
Michael, the Fed just announced that it'll buy $600 billion in bonds. Senator Judd Gregg, the Republican from New Hampshire, says the U.S. could soon become another Greece. Do you agree?
Soon become another Greece? I think the only thing separating us from Greece right now is the color of the currency. It's all funny money. It's shocking. I mean, what do they mean by buying these bonds? What they mean is they're going to print money. What they mean is they're going to diminish the value of everyone's dollar in their pocket by 10 to 15 or 20%. It's a nightmare to think that we have such amateurs in charge of our money supply. It's a disaster. Instead of doing that, they should cut spending by 20%. They should fire 20% of the federal bureaucracy, eliminate whole departments. Then you would see the dollar strengthen and the world start to pay attention to us in a serious way again.
What about national security? Do you think President Obama will change his approach to the threat of radical Islam in the wake of the recently thwarted mail bomb terror plots?
No, I don't think so. I think he's in denial, just as he is with the results of the election. I don't think when you have a president and a Department of Homeland Security and an FBI that refuse to even acknowledge radical Islam as the enemy, what chance do we have to even identify the enemy? The only people who know who the enemy is are the soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq, by the way, who are still taking bullets with the name radical Islam written all over them. This president is living in a dreamland. He's like King Ludwig II of ancient Bavaria. And I have a terrible fear he's going to get much worse before he is before he's reined in by his own party.
Michael, thanks so much for joining us. Where can folks find your best-selling book, Trickle Up Poverty?
Oh, they better find it in every bookstore in America.
All right, Michael Savage, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Savage. Well, it was a good interview. You know, I did that on the spur of the moment on a telephone without any notes in front of me. I remember doing it last week, Newsmax. I mean, we arranged it in advance, but I did it with a telephone. I did it without a book in front of me. I didn't need a teleprompter. I didn't need anyone holding up cue cards because truly I have a complete mastery of my subject matter. And now that we've covered politics for the day, we can go to the magazines I bought in the bookstore. So in front of me, I have Hemings Motor News for November 2010, Plane and Pilot for this month, Plane and Pilot, the magazine for active piston engine pilots, Yachting Magazine, let's see, Innovative Design Trends, Winter Charter Escape to the Virgin Islands, Is the St. Barth's Bucket the Ultimate Regatta? And then I have PMY, that's not PMS, PMY, Power and Motor Yacht, America's 100 largest yacht. I don't really want a big boat like that. I never dreamed of it. I don't want it. I'm not one of the, I don't like people that much where I want to be with a crowd on a boat. See, that's the problem with a large boat, is you kind of go with a group and show off. I don't understand. I mean, I'm not a party guy. Maybe that's why I'm not that happy. I don't know. Maybe I should be a party guy with a couch and champagne and drugs and starlets. But at this point in my life, I don't think I'm going to change horses in midstream. So America's 100 largest yachts, and they list them. You know who owns the biggest yacht in the world? Where is it? Oh, it's number 7 Musashi at 288 feet? Oh, sorry. America's 100 largest yacht. Who gets the biggest? Here it is, Rising Sun, 452 feet, built by Lürssen Shipyards in Germany. Octopus at 414 feet. Number 3 is a Le Grand Bleu, 370 foot. Limitless, you know, that's pretty amazing. It's men do these things to show who's bigger, so to speak. I guess if you have unlimited money, there are very few ways to do it. It says, in the yacht spotting world, the most exciting news is often unconfirmed. Blah, 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 blah. All of this combined makes FedShip's launch of Musashi even more intriguing. Hints as to her owner's identity include her Japan-influenced name. Musashi was a 16th century samurai, and her exterior styling. These clues point to Larry Ellison as the owner. Ellison is a known penchant for all things Japanese. So, I mean, does that matter? Whatever. Famous owner, this and that. How do you entertain yourself on a show? I don't understand it. I have a family member who enjoys this, by the way. You see what happens is I've gotten older. It's not that I've gotten more tolerant. I've gotten more of an understanding of people in the sense that it goes back to the 60s, different strokes for different folks. You know what I'm saying? If you enjoy being on a ship with 10 friends, having a good time, God bless you. I don't. I have a large boat, but I handle it alone. To me, the idea of going out is me and the dog. Why? Because I talk for a living. I don't want to go on a boat and talk for 10 days. And the idea of getting off the boat with the launch and going ashore and going to another dinner and seeing other nouveau riche, you know, everyone's showing. Well, all right, maybe if you're in a different state of mind, it's entertaining for a while. But I never wanted the James Bond lifestyle. I don't think, maybe I'm lying to myself. I don't know. Who knows? You know, you got to ask yourself, because as a kid, I loved sports cars. I was fascinated by fast cars and slow women. I mean, I loved sports. You remember that joke? That joke went the other way. But today, I like fast cars, but I drive them slowly. Let's put it to you that way. I've become the guy with the fast car in the middle lane doing 63 and a half miles an hour. I don't even enjoy speeding. What's the point? I mean, the sound of an engine, a great engine like in a Ferrari at 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 RPM is something to behold. But you can do that in the garage with the engine in neutral if you just want to hear the engine making noise. I mean, speed is a very dangerous thing on a regular road, so I tend to stay within the speed limits. So there, we've covered boats and cars. Now what's next? Oh, on the cover of Hemmings Motor News. Am I boring you yet? Because you can call about politics. You can call about the Newsmax interview, whatever you want. We can talk about Obama's trip, and I mean his travels to India, because that has another connotation in San Francisco, as you can see by the people who run the city. When you talk about their trip, in that case, you're really talking about their trip, but you have to use the word travel to get it right. So the front cover of Hemmings Motor News caught my eye for one reason. It says buyer's guide, and it shows a 1956 Oldsmobile and how, you know, restoration tools entails, blah, blah, blah. The first car I ever owned was a 55 Oldsmobile. It was a two-door with a pillar. I was embarrassed that it wasn't like a coupe. Dad bought it for me when I was 17. The first car I ever had, I can remember to this day, the day he brought that car home, a 55 Olds, green, all green. It was like a salesman's car. You know, they had different models. It was for salesmen. It was a two-door, not the coupe, not the fancy one. And he brought it home. I'll never forget, as long as I live, rainy night, like a light rain. Let's see, what age it must have been, in the springtime, light rain. And I remember looking out the window of our little house in Queens, New York, at that car, sitting there in the rain. It was the most beautiful car I'd ever seen in the world. It was stunningly attractive, my first car. So what do you want me to say? First loves, first car, first alcohol, first joint, first woman, first sewer plant, whatever. I'll be back. Savage. Oh, what do you want to talk about? What is Obama doing in India? I don't know what he's doing in India. It seems like a big show of force to me. The question is he trying to, like, intimidate Pakistan or trying to buttress India? Maybe both. Of course, he's sampling Indian food. They've even created a special Obama platter for him to eat as he meets with the Indian PM. And what's in it? Tandoori Ran, which is a whole marinated and barbecued leg of lamb, for those of you who are animal rights activists, or Murg Kurchan, which is chicken in butter tomato sauce puke, and of course there's Kulfi, Indian ice cream. That's right. Wherever he goes, Michelle has to have her ice cream. So I guess the adage of this administration will be let them eat ice cream and then come back and tell them to eat carrots. That's right. Obama and his health-conscious wife have gone halfway around the world to eat ice cream again. But what's really shocking is how he's answering questions from people in India, something he almost never does for people in the United States. In fact, an Indian schoolchild asked a more intelligent question than Chip Reed of NBC. In fact, an Indian schoolchild asked a more intelligent question on the entire press corps. In fact, that's why when Indians come here, within 6 months, they win the spelling bee, because they're very intelligent people and very hardworking. And the child asked him, what does he think of, what is the word jihad? And of course, he prevaricated. Now, very soon, the president will be going to it's like a homecoming. He's going to go to Indonesia. And that'll be a very special visit for him. It'll be like me visiting Flushing, New York. In that he went to a madrasa in Indonesia as a young boy. And just as I went to PS 48 in the Bronx, he went to a madrasa. A madrasa. It's something bizarre about this whole thing. We've never had a laughable situation like this with a president in my life. I mean, we've had maniacs like Warren Harding with the women running around, the illegitimate child. I mean, so I don't think this is the first time we've had a, you know, somebody didn't belong there in the White House. It's not the first time. But things are a little different now. The world was a different place when Warren Harding was making it with shopkeepers and hiding the offspring in the White House closets. You know, it's a different world today. Between Twitter and this one and the nuclear weapons in the hands of jihadists, you can't have a Warren Harding in the White House. Chevy 55 to 57. I don't know. My mind is wandering now. You know why I'm wandering back to like cars and stuff? Because it's when America was like a different kind of country. It was safer. You know, it was like I look at movies from the 70s. I love 70s movies for a couple of reasons on TV. My favorite are 70s gangster movies. Because if you see New York street scenes, 99% of the cars are American. Big monster Goliath cars. That's number one. The men are all wearing nice clothing. They don't look like homeless bums walking the streets of Manhattan. The world has changed radically, obviously. But the cars were different, the clothing. How about 60s movies where all the women wore white gloves? Can you imagine that? That women wore gloves in America? There was an age when there were men, like I knew guys who like were manufacturers. Some of my friends' fathers had more money. They were glove manufacturers. In Long Island City, where the guy had a corrugated carton factory, they were considered the rich ones. They had like the bigger Oldsmobile or the Cadillac if they made gloves in a factory. Now there were like movie studios and web design factories where they actually made things. Now they make nothing but pornography and imagery.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
That is Dion and the Belmonts from Another Time in America, before the word jihad was even known, when the jihadis was before they were permitted to come in to the country and basically cause havoc. 1-800-449-8000. So we could talk about cars, boats, planes, or you know what I want to talk about for a few minutes? The Greek gods. For some reason, I was very lucky because I had a classical high school education before I went to college and grad school. And this was Jamaica High School, Queens, New York. In those days, it was a tough school. And we had to learn a language. Then in college, I had to learn two languages to get through Queens College. You had to learn them and examine them, believe it or not. Today, you don't even have to speak English to get through Queens College. In fact, if you speak English, you're considered a racist. At most colleges today, if you speak English too well, you're probably investigated by the Department of Homeland Security. Anyone who speaks English too well is looked upon as somewhat suspect by the TSA. They get a double frisking. What a country we live in. It's like an upside down world to me. I'm like, you know, you know, it's another world, you know, Rip Van Savage here. The reason I mentioned the Greek gods is because in high school, I had to learn the Greek gods. In high school, we had to be somewhat familiar with the Greek gods. So you say, well, what do you need that crap for? Well, no, would you rather learn the rap artists with gold teeth or bling in their nostrils? Now, why did we have to study the Greek gods? Well, because the Greek mythological culture had a lot to do with Western literature. Greek mythological literature. And some of you would know some of the names. For example, we just, Aphrodite. If I say Aphrodite, the average person who's read anything would know who Aphrodite was. Or if I say the gods such as, let me name some of the Greek gods, okay? And some of you know it because you've had, you know, good educations. You don't have to be a scholar to know what these mean. But the average person in my day would have known who these deities were. Ancient gods in modern faces. You say, well, I don't want to know that I'm a Christian or I'm Jewish. I don't even want to hear it. It doesn't mean that you have to worship the ancient gods in order to be an educated person. You should know a lot of things that you don't have to follow. I mean, you could know how an addict puts heroin in his arm. It doesn't mean you have to shoot heroin in your arm, for example. You know, don't be so afraid of learning. Learning isn't so terrifying. So the gods of Greece are an interesting subject, which you'll see where I'm going to get to in a minute. Who are they? Poseidon, Apollo, Artemis, Aphrodite, Dionysus, Zeus, Athena, Hera, Hestia, Ares, Hephaestus, Demeter, Hades, Hermes. Some of these you probably have some familiarity. Everyone listening to this show has heard the words, the name Zeus, right? Or you saw a movie, The Poseidon Adventure, so you know what Poseidon. Poseidon, Aphrodite. Okay, if I say Aphrodite, what do you think of? I'm not interested in Aphrodite. Today I'm interested in Dionysus. That's why I play Dion in the Belmonts. Because Dionysus rose from the depths of ancient civilization and tore the Apollonian order apart. Dionysus was also known as Bacchus. He was the god of pleasure, basically. And as you well know, our society today is given over to pleasure to the extent that Bacchus or Dionysus would be the god that would probably rule America, other than Jesus or God himself. And our civilization is now crumbling as a result of the Dionysian elements that are within man, that have been somewhat controlled, that have now broken free or been let out of the cage, so to speak. As early as 186 before Christ, the Roman Senate actually issued a proclamation that suppressed all Bacchic societies throughout Italy as a conspiracy against the state. Now look where we've come to today. Look where we've come today. Take a look at where we are today, where Bacchus or Dionysus is revered, held up as the role model. And, you know, these were considered at a certain time something to be suppressed, kept underground, kept in the hidden background. And we were supposed to be rigid and self-controlled. Right? Well, the question is, what's the balance? What's the balance point? Is it to let yourself go completely? No, because you wind up like that actor, whatever his name was, who was the cocaine and the hooker a few weeks ago. You don't want to be like him. Or the slut girls of Hollywood. In my day, even if they were like that, they made believe that they were ladies. Today, they hide the ladyhood in them because the degenerates who run Hollywood want their women. They actually hate women. You don't understand this. It's something that's very hard for you to understand. The degenerates who run Hollywood hate women. And so, therefore, they want women to debase themselves with drugs, with alcohol, and with sexuality. Don't you understand how this works? The degenerates hate women. So, therefore, any woman who is debased in that manner, they put up on a pedestal. That's how I see it. And so, I'm talking about this, right? So, madness, violence, wildness, terror, God's double nature. Is liberalism about liberation? Is liberalism about liberation? Yes, to the child, to the average child, they think that liberals stand for liberation, ecstasy, and inspiration, and they think that a conservative stands for the opposite. But in fact, your daughter is more likely to wind up in the hands of those bringing about madness, violence, wildness, and terror as a result of the liberalism that is now raging through the universities. Do you understand that? Okay. So that's what we're talking about. So which way do you want your children to go? Do you want them to be overly rigid? You can't raise a child that way today. Cannot do it. If you do, they're going to rebel and they're going to go the opposite way. On the other hand, if you're going to let them just, you know, don't do anything I wouldn't do, that kind of child rearing. You ever hear those parents, the Marin County Upper East Side women. Oh, well, honey, don't do anything I wouldn't do, they say to the daughter at 14. So the daughter doesn't do anything she wouldn't do, and the daughter's in rehab at 14 and a half. That's all. Goes out with a pair of pants on her. I mean, it's unbelievable to me, the way they walk around today. Poor women. Poor women. I see children today. I'm just rambling. Today I'm a rambling man. Last week, I almost did a whole show last week about my feelings about children. I look at children when I see them, and I feel bad for them. Little children. I feel bad for them. I look at them, and my heart hurts for them. I know he's saying, well, what are you giving to the Bleeding Heart? What are you, a Bleeding Heart liberal or something? No, if I see kids, there's a lot of children in the Marin County area, and I divide my time between a number of different communities. And this is a rookery out here. Many of the liberal white families flee the city of San Francisco once they have children in order to give them an education where they won't be mugged and have their clothing robbed and their lunch money stolen. And so they come out to the truth. I mean, you want me to, you know, to talk about it. They come to the safe white suburbs. I don't blame them. They're afraid to raise their kids where the kid is going to be mauled. So anyway, they're here, and they continue their liberalism here. But you see the children, and I look at children 3, 4, 5, and they're running and they're just average. You don't like any child through the ages, any race, any culture. But I look at them and I say, what future is waiting for these kids? You know, when you have a government that is so avaricious that it will really put into debt children unto the fourth generation of this country in order to aggrandize themselves and hold on to power, they'll bankrupt us unto the fourth generation. I look at these children and I fear for them. But it's not only the monetary element that I worry about. I mean, that is a bad one, but that's not what I'm really getting at. I fear that they're going to wind up slaves. I swear to God, my guts tell me these little white children are going to wind up enslaved by the third world. And I have reason to say that to you. And the reason is that the white liberal would like to see the people of this country enslaved. They say that we exploited the world, we exploited the resources of the world, and that to them there's nothing that a third worlder can't do, that cannot do, that's not good. And there's nothing that an American can do that is good. Nothing. And so they say, well, it's, you know, it's turnaround. It's fair game. And they'd like to see the children in this country turned into little slaves. And that's what I fear. So you say, well, come on, that's absurd. We have the strongest military on earth. What is the good of a strong military when you have men like Robert Gates, the defense secretary, who over the weekend gives a speech and says, quickly, hush, hush. Pass, don't ask, don't tell while the Congress is not in session. This is a man who's cut one military expenditure after another that has to do with weapons systems, and now he's spending all of his time trying to push don't ask, don't tell. Why don't you ask the men who are actually taking the bullets what they think about don't ask, don't tell? Don't ask me. Ask them what they think it'll do to the military. Well, let's go another step. I read last week that the geniuses under Obama are now going to put women on submarines. Now, I ask you something. I'm going to ask you something. I know there are brave women. I've met them. I've seen helicopter pilots who are women. I understand that there are women who can be as fine a pilot as a man. But don't you understand what happens when you put a woman on a submarine? Do you understand what's going to happen on that submarine where you have a tight, cohesive group that works together like a well-oiled machine, and you're going to put 5 women on a submarine? You're going to tell me there's not going to be a little vying for that woman? That's exactly what they want. They want to wreck the unit cohesion. And they want lawsuits. And let me tell you something else. If it's a choice between another torpedo and a toilet, they're going to build that toilet, and they're going to eliminate that torpedo tube. That's why I wrote Trickle-Up Poverty, Obama's War on Our Borders, Economy, and Security, stupid. Wake up. It's all planned. I'll be back.
Savage.
So, you know, the president's in India, and it makes me want to have Indian food, but I got sick from it last week, the buffet, so I'm not going to go, truthfully. I mean, that's probably more important to me than the gods of Greece or anything else is what I'm going to have for dinner. No, it comes down to it, truthfully. I'm a strange guy. As I'm eating lunch, which was leftover Chinese from last night, I thought about dinner. You say, well, why don't you just cook your own food? I do as much as I can, but it's hard to cook your own food. It's a lot of work. So one family member says, why don't you get a chef? I don't want a chef. Then you have to eat the same food every day. And I don't trust anyone in the house that well enough anyway. I mean, because what if they're sick? You know what I mean? You don't know what anyone, the same, well, the same with a restaurant. I came from an immigrant, you know, immigrant family. They were not rich. They weren't poor. Don't get me wrong. I'm not going to make into a big story that everyone was in poverty. They worked themselves out of poverty, but they didn't eat in restaurants much. In fact, I had relatives who never ate in a restaurant. They were a family, like almost like a they whispered about them. They never won't go to a restaurant. It's not that they didn't want to spend the money. They didn't trust the food. Today, it's different. Everyone's equally sick wherever they eat. No matter where they eat, they come away feeling slightly ill. No, I eat in a restaurant. Just, you got to watch out certain foods, that's all. You want me to read his menu again? I don't want to read his menu. I had a buffet. I'm the only one. I told you about the buffet last week, the Indian takeout buffet. I sent my assistant. I won't even go to the buffet anymore. I had the assistant go there and get it for me. But you overeat in buffets anyway, you know, all you can eat. How can you go to a buffet and not come away feeling like slightly nauseous from it? I don't have that much self-control around an all-you-can-eat buffet. I can eat one plate and then leave. It's impossible. I cannot do it. So I tend to avoid buffets for that reason. That's why I avoid South Florida. All of South Florida is a buffet. There was one buffet near where I have a house in Florida. I knew they wouldn't last. Poor Chinese people. They hardly spoke English. They rented this monster, huge facility, and it was like you felt bad for them when you went in there. You know the type, like they don't quite understand the restaurant business, and they pooled their money. Oh, it was sad, and they put a buffet out, and the only people who went there were either very hard workers, illegal aliens, or whatever, and they ate like 5, 6, 7, 8 plates. I really enjoyed it for a while, but I knew it couldn't last, and I went by there last time it was gone already. All right, that's what happens. You cannot make money in an all-you-can-eat buffet in this economy. Impossible. Unless you're serving, you know, really leftover dreck from the night before. And then you're not going to have whatever. I don't know. Did I have a good meal? I ate something good over there. I got a headache now from wine again. Remember I was doing good on the red wine? Very expensive red wine I started drinking again. I had a hangover Saturday. It lasted till Sunday night from a half a bottle of red wine. I cannot drink it. I loved it going down. But I never want to repeat the experience. Back to the same. Beer and vodka, that's all. All right, Las Vegas. Sherry, you're on the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I was intrigued by what you were saying about the ancient gods and this idea of the Apollonian system of life that was basically overthrown by, I don't know, basic hedonism, I guess.
Hedonism.
I'm a Latin teacher. And I really...
Wow, somebody can still teach Latin in the United States of America?
Definitely, Latin and ancient Greek, as a matter of fact.
What kind of school do you teach in without giving away the name of the school?
I've taught in public schools, but right now I teach in a private school, non-secondary.
Isn't that wonderful? I think it's so wonderful for children to learn Latin. It's amazing how that broadens their mind and, of course, gives them the facility to learn all of the Romance languages, so to speak. Hey, why are they called Romance languages, by the way?
Because they derive from the Roman language of Latin.
Language. That's where the word romance comes from. You mean the Romans were great lovers?
Well, probably not, especially if you read their letters. I think that they were actually maybe not so good at it, but actually just romance coming from the Romans themselves.
So Aphrodite is the goddess of beauty. People would know that today, correct? The average person would know that, Aphrodite?
Correct.
Of all the Greek gods, who would you say would be the one that the average American would recognize if you mentioned the Greek gods? Who would they recognize instantly? Would it be Zeus, Apollo? Which one?
Probably Zeus.
And who was Zeus? He was the god of?
He was the god of men and gods, of the sky, of the heavens.
Have you ever heard this one, A Night with Venus and a Lifetime with Mercury?
It certainly makes sense that...
Oh, you got the joke. That was an old joke from before my day.
Savage.
God bless the piston engine. Welcome back to the Savage Nation. It's a beautiful time of year. It really is my favorite. You know, you're coming into Thanksgiving. I'm sorry to mention, I went to Macy's today to buy some more sweatshirts. And he already had the Christmas music. The guy, he's a nice guy. He's, I think, Afghani. I don't know. I always shop there, and he's always the same guy. He says, "Hello, Michael. How are you?" Blah, blah, blah. So I said, "Already you got the Christmas music running?" He said, "Oh, every year it gets earlier and earlier." He said to me. I said, "Already they're running the Christmas music?" He says, "Oh, soon it'll be running in summer to boost sales." One thing you got to say about international trade is that the goods are cheap. I never saw such cheap garbage. Everything's made in China. I bought a jacket to replace my homeless bicycle jacket, which is at least 20 years old with a ripped zipper. To replace the zipper would have cost more than to buy the jacket I bought. But sure enough, made in China. A book review came out. I'm not going to read it to you. You know, it's from the Ideal Taxes Association. And they love my book. And I'm not, you got to read it. It's up on michaelsavage.com. And they talk about the late, great climate scam, cap and tax. They actually disagree with me on something, which I thought was very intriguing. That's why I'm reading this. Each chapter is full of anecdotes and interesting observations that will be new to the reader. For example, the health bill puts the IRS in charge of ensuring that people comply with their obligations to remain insured. The bill calls for establishing a Ready Reserve Corps, whose commissioned officers shall be appointed by the president and be available and ready for involuntary calls to active duty during national emergencies and public health crises. Well, it's all in the book, so here's where they disagree with me. They say, Michael Savage says no to the VAT tax. We disagree for a variety of reasons. But they don't like my idea on tariffs. They say Savage would impose tariffs on imports from China. He wrote, "We must draw a line in the sand with regard to China in order to loosen their stranglehold on our economy by imposing a 20% tariff on all goods produced in China. That tariff should be raised by 5% each year that China refuses to revalue her currency." Close quote. He then says, the writer now, the reviewer from the tax group, says, "This proposal is similar to that of Professor Paul Krugman, a free trader, has made. We have a different position. We believe that currency revaluations don't work well. Countries that pursue mercantilist policies can easily nullify its effects. What we favor is our own invention, scale tariffs, which would be imposed only on goods from countries with which we have large chronic deficits, like China, Germany, Japan, and others. The rates would go up if the trade deficit increases, and down when it decreases, and disappear when trade is brought close to balance." They then write, "Savage would keep the estate tax at zero. We disagree for a variety of reasons. The argument that it forces the sale of inherited businesses is specious in our opinion. The tax can be postponed until the business is sold." Well, wait a minute. It's still a tax, though. My point is that the estate tax, even if you postpone it until you sell the business, it means your children cannot, many children can't own the business you give them. You worked all your life for a farm. Now you're going to give the farm to your child and they have to pay a 50% estate tax, which means they often lose the farm to pay the taxes. Savage says no to the VAT tax. They say the VAT is currently rebated to exporters and blah, 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 and they like VAT. And Savage is right when he writes, "We don't need more taxes. We need less government spending, waste, and fraud." They say, "We have one qualification. We have no objection to user taxes like taxes on motor fuel to pay for road and street construction and maintenance. Aside from these differences on taxes and tariffs, which are topics within our area of expertise and not his, Michael Savage has written a great book and we recommend it to our readers." This came out of nowhere. It's from a group called Ideal Taxes Association. What I'm getting, I have to do this now. I'll tell you why I read that review. It's very interesting that they disagreed with me, number one. I thought I'd share that with you. When I went to the bookstore the other day for the first time in a long time, I looked at the bestseller list. I picked up my book. And then I picked up the competition. I didn't know that the comedian's book was a picture book. I had no idea it was only pictures. There was virtually no words in it. That's number one. What it really shocked me, though, was that the leprechaun's book, which was behind mine, was half the size of my book. My book is like 300 and... That's a lot of pages, okay? 300 and... I don't have the number. It's right in front of me here. 360-some-odd pages with references. The Lep's book was 180. Same price. And I said, maybe I wrote too much of a book. I tend to give too much in any one. It's like a radio show. I give you three shows in one. You know, maybe my next book shouldn't be 362 pages. Maybe it's too long. Maybe people would rather have volume one, volume two. But, you know, most of the people who write books, and half of it's like, you know, like video, pictures of themselves inside it, or pictures of letters. It's like, I don't even know why people buy them. It's like the filler. And then you got the professor comes out, the guy with the fake glasses and the blackboards. Nothing in there. I have no idea why everyone buys his books. I don't get it. Why would anyone need his book in a library? Could anyone tell me, without mentioning his name, why you would buy the Crybaby's books? What is in that book? The man with the blackboard. You know I'm talking about, the illiterate, the high school dropout, the genius with the 18 blackboards, and every day he gets another illness, a hysterical blindness, hysterical throat, and then he gets miraculously cured at Mormon hospitals with secret lotions. I don't understand how anyone... What's in the book that you need? I'm the only one who was a scholar prior to being a talk show host. So therefore, I bring a scholarly background to a book. To me, a book is a serious business. It's serious business. Well, anyway, I say there's room for a lot of books down there. I mean, of course, I like to only see my book. If I was Kim Jong-il, it would be only one book in a bookstore, my book. But I'm not Kim Jong-il. See, to the radical Muslim, there should be no books except the Quran. All of the books should be burned. You don't understand this, do you? You have no idea who your enemy is. You have no idea what they want to do to you. None. You have the slightest idea. You're brainwashed. Here's an article comes out today. Radical Yemeni cleric Anwar al-Awlaki calls for killing of Americans. All Americans should be killed, he says in a new video. He said, Americans are from the party of devils, and so they do not require any special religious permission to kill them. In a 23-minute Arabic language message entitled, Make It Known and Clear to Mankind, it was either them or us, he says. And he says, therefore, you can kill all Americans because we're devils. Can you believe we're dealing with this kind of personality? This is the man who had email contacts with the army psychiatrist, the Muslim Major Hassan, who killed 13 people and shot 32. And screamed, by the way, Allah Akbar, and went on a jihad. Tell that to the president. Since returning to Yemen in 06, al-Awlaki has moved beyond inspiration and taken a role as an active operative in al-Qaeda's affiliate there. It's terrifying. It is terrifying to think we have a president and directors of Homeland Security and this security and that security. They won't even define it as terror. What is it then if it's not terrorism and terror? I can guarantee you if he went to gun an airplane in full Arabic garb, they'd sweep him right aboard because they wouldn't want to offend him. But your grandmother in a wheelchair wearing a nun's habit, they give her a, do I have to spell it out for you in a vulgar manner? I'm not Milton Berle. Let's go to Houston, Texas. Nathan, you're on the Savage Nation. Line 6, go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, I talked to you a few weeks ago, gave you the idea about taking your book into the poll booth.
Yes.
And I had a good experience with it, went off without a hitch, but I did want to tell you about my travels with your copy that you sent me.
Uh-oh. So you took it into the voting booth and nothing happened except people commented positively. But you took it to go on an airplane, and what happened?
Well, I was flying from Houston to Newark Liberty, and I had your book in my carry-on. And for some reason, I got singled out to be the guy who goes to the full body scan.
That's terrible. That's terrible. But what if you had an Arabic language book called How to Make a Bomb? Would they have given you a dispensation?
No, I pulled the TSA. I told them I don't want to go through. I don't want to deal with this. I don't want the radiation off this thing. You show me just cause that I should go through this. They weren't hearing it. I finally have to go through it. I find the TSA manager, and I say, so let me know. Am I the guy you're looking for? Am I the profile? You know, I'm a young,
right,
young white sales executive, traveling nicely.
What did he say to you?
He goes. Well, here's a website you can follow up on that. He gives me a sticky note, a little sticky note that says www.tsa.gov. He says follow up.
Wait, I understand you can opt out of radiation and you can get a body.
Try it at an airport, Dr. Savage. I wasn't going to go that far down the road.
Treat you like you're a criminal. You're a criminal. To Janet Napolitano, all Americans are criminals. All Americans are criminals to Janet Napolitano, big sis. It's a disgrace, and we need people to stand up and say, hell no, you're not going to do this to me anymore. You go through this.
You get body scanned. You make every member of Congress get body scanned and rectally examined by these damn throwback thugs. We've got this invasion of our privacy and our private parts. The reason you're not hearing an outcry is because Nancy Pelosi flies in Air Force jets. The members of Senate and Congress do not go through this. You know that, don't you?
Yep.
Well, I'm telling you, I think we need to have a day where a million people say, no, you're not frisking me, and I'm not going through radiation.
Yeah.
I'm an architect. I'm not a builder. I'll be right back.
Now, because of the incredible rise of India and China and Brazil and other countries, you know, the United States remains the largest economy and the largest market, but there's real competition out there. And that's potentially healthy.
So there's Obama in India saying it's healthy that America's economy has declined, boasting that India has basically overtaken us. China overtaken us, Brazil rising, and he's happy with that. Now, I allege in my book and in the chapter Nightmare on Wall Street that, in fact, the entire Wall Street meltdown was orchestrated. I'm going to read you a paragraph. And so Barack Obama inherited a situation any leftist would love. Left-leaning hedge fund managers and their cronies appear to have engineered a financial crisis that they could blame on the capitalist pigs, and in turn elect one of their own on the grounds that the capitalists themselves had undermined the very foundations on which they built their empires. Obama used this phony leverage to enact less than a month after his inauguration a nearly 1,000-page stimulus bill that requires the government to borrow upwards of $800 billion. This added to the national debt and tying up capital that would otherwise be available to fund private sector expansion that might actually create jobs. There's another element in this. The bill said that they were going to fund shovel-ready local, state, and federal construction projects. The fact is there were almost no such shovel-ready projects ready to be funded. And in fact, we just learned that there were almost no shovel-ready projects at all. A year after its passage, this bill has had little effect except to contribute to international credit ratings agency Moody's threat to downgrade the U.S. credit rating. And so when I say to you, we have a president traipsing around the world like an ancient pharaoh, and he goes to India and is basically crowing how well India is doing and how badly we're doing, saying, well, there's real competition out there, and that's potentially healthy. No, it's not potentially healthy. What do you mean it's potentially healthy? Tell that to the million people losing their houses. This is a nightmare. It's a takeover of our economy by a group of radical Marxists with Obama at the head of the cabal. That's why you threw them out of office. That's why you threw 60 of them out on their behinds. But I warned you, you've got a lame duck Congress right now that's still in power with the very same people you want out of there. They're liable to pass laws between now and the end of the year. I warned you last time, 2 years ago, I warned you that Bush was not finished wrecking the economy. I warned you. The very same time of year you were thinking of turkeys and Santa Claus. Do you remember what I said to you in the beginning of November, in those last few months of the reign of George W. Bush? Oh, now he's a newly invented George Bush. Everybody loves him with a little help from Wallbanger now. Everyone's favorite former president, Mr. Kind and Gentle George W. Bush, the first American socialist, economic socialist president, George Bush. The first modern economically socialist president in the Republican Party, so far as I can tell, was Nixon. Nixon did it first. But let's put that aside. I warned you in October of that year before Obama was made president, right after the election, that Bush was just going to do things, that was about to do things to us that you wouldn't even believe. And it was soon thereafter that things happened between November and December that was simply a shock to this country. And they paved the way for Obama to come in and do what he's been doing to us. All right, let's take the callers. By the way, I'm trying to think of Tup family horror stories. Do you have any Tup family horror stories? Like you brought the book home and you try to show it to your wife or your hippie sister-in-law and what happened? I'd like to hear some Tup family horror stories running right up to Thanksgiving. I think it's a great book to bring to Thanksgiving dinners if you've got nothing to talk about but the gravy. John in New York on WOR, welcome to the Savage Nation.
I did what you told me to do. I gave those two copies of Quick Love Poverty that you sent to me to two family members that really need to read them.
Oh.
And, you know, two lifelong Democrats.
Yeah, what happened?
I really think it moved them, Dr. Savage. I'm going to be very honest with you. These are two guys who I don't think could ever be moved. They read half of your book, they both told me, and they said, you know, there's a lot of good points in there, points I never even thought of in my whole 65 years on this planet.
Well, that's because they're older men who are willing to read. They pride themselves on their mental facilities, and they're actually probably people who grew up reading. So they read it. They figured, all right, let me read the book. And they're probably shocked that it wasn't just empty pages full of, rhetoric.
More listeners, too, because they are now going to start listening, and they're going to start, I guess you can teach an old dog new tricks.
Well, especially when the old dog suddenly realizes that the government's not its friend.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, you got a president over there saying that he's happy that India, China, and Brazil have risen and that we're no longer really number one anymore, and that's potentially healthy. I mean, this guy's loyalty is really an issue today.
Listen to that man. Whenever he's on, I change the station. I can't listen to that man's voice anymore.
Who can't you listen?
Obama. I can't listen to anything that man says. My blood pressure goes up. My heart starts palpitating. I can't listen to that man anymore.
You're kidding. It's that bad already?
Yes, I cannot. It was that bad 2 years ago when he got elected. I can't listen to this man anymore. He makes me nervous. He's hazardous to my health. He really is.
That's very interesting. I almost have the same reaction to him. I swear to God. I see him now, and I see a naked liar, and a very dangerous naked liar who says everything that he can to embarrass America wherever he is and lie to us. But are we alone? Are we the only two people in America who react to him this way?
Not. If my grandfather was alive right now, I'm glad he's not here to see this. Both my grandfathers.
He is an extremist. You got to understand something. We use the word extremist to a great extent in America. Obama is an extremist president. Would you say that that's a valid description of him?
Absolutely.
Okay. See, I don't think anyone's used that word with him. He's an extremist president. Now the media suddenly, he represents the liberal wing of the party, and now they're suddenly talking about the right wing and the left wing. Before the election, there was no left wing. You know that. All they talked about was the right wing, the right wing, the right wing, with a sneer and a snicker and a derision. Now all of a sudden they're saying, well, Nancy Pelosi represents the left wing of the party. Suddenly there's a left wing all of a sudden. They discovered it, huh? I'll use another phrase now, because I've been calling them what they are for years now. Obama, I would suggest, is an extremist president. He represents the furthest extreme of the left wing that we have ever seen in the presidency. He is an extremist president, and he has brought disaster to the Democrat Party. And now they can't even shake free of Nancy Pelosi. She doesn't want to let go, and I think that's a blessing from God himself. Her egomania will be a blessing to America. I say, run, Nancy, run. Stay in there. Hold on, girl. Don't let it go. I want you to be the minority leader because we need you. If ever we needed anyone to typify the excesses and the extremism of the Democrat Party, it's, with all respect, Nancy Pelosi.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You
here's what's on michaelsavage.com. Obama says in India that Islam has been distorted by a few extremists. He was responding to a student who invited his opinion on jihad during his town hall style agitprop meeting at Mumbai St. Xavier's College. And the great leader, or shall I say the great escape artist, who fled town after he destroyed the Democrat Party, has asserted that Islam is a religion of peace, fairness, and tolerance that is being distorted by a few extremists. The phrase jihad has a lot of meaning within Islam, is subject to a lot of different interpretations, he said, but I will say that, first, Islam is one of the world's great religions. That's true. He then said more than a billion people practice Islam. An overwhelming majority view their obligations to a religion that reaffirms peace, fairness, tolerance. Blah, blah, blah. I think all of us recognize that this great religion is in the hands of a few extremists, has been distorted by violence. Okay. That's very nice. I think that's very nice. I only pray to God that the Muslims hear him. Right?
Exactly. Good luck.
He also offered inspiration by alluding to Gandhiji's simple lifestyle from what he saw at Mani Bhavan. Of course, if he actually studied Gandhi's life, he would find something different. Gandhi was a con man. People don't know that. I know that Gandhi is a sacred cow, but the whole underwear picture is a somewhat of a distortion, incidentally, Beowulf.
Maybe in both cases, the emperor has no clothes.
Yeah, and also Gandhi, by the way, created Pakistan. In order for the Hindus to live in peace with the Muslims, he suggested the Muslims move to a new country called Pakistan. And during this idealistic journey, 1 million people were killed.
That's right.
In riots and murder. You know that.
In the late 1940s, that's exactly what happened.
This is a man who changed history like probably no one else in the 20th century, said Obama, in terms of the number of lives he affected. Well, it's true. He had a million of them killed each other. Anyway, look, the guy is just a shallow whatever. And there's more to this story than meets the eye. And we have to ask ourselves, just what is Obama doing in India? Less than a week after the biggest midterm election defeat in the last 60 years, the president has followed Hillary Clinton's lead in his globetrotting in Asia. Nobody seems to know why he's spending $200 million a day to go there. Nobody seems to know why he's brought 34 ships, warships, along with him. What we do know is that at a price of about $200 million a day, according to Indian reports, he and his wife are soaking up the local culture. They're in India dancing the night away, dancing with children. Have you ever seen a serious president dancing with children? I've heard of dancing with stars. Is this the message of strength that Obama is sending to the world? And, of course, he's sampling Indian food. They've even created a special Obama platter for him to eat as he meets with the Indian PM. What's in it? Tandoori ron, which is a whole marinated and barbecued leg of lamb. Murg kushan, which is chicken and butter, tomato sauce.
Jesus.
And kulfi, Indian ice cream. There it goes again. That's right. Obama and his health-conscious wife have gone halfway around the world to eat ice cream again. It's unbelievable.
Jesus.
It's always ice cream with her.
In Spain.
But what's really shocking is how Obama is answering questions from people in India, something he almost never does for people in the United States. When asked his opinion of jihad, the president prevaricated and said, jihad was subject to a lot of different interpretations. Really, I seem to recall that Major Nidal Hassan, who killed 13 and wounded 32 at Fort Hood, he pretty clearly knew what jihad meant, didn't it? It meant kill the infidel, right?
He had a pretty strong interpretation of what it meant, yeah.
He refused to denounce Pakistan as a terrorist state. And then further, Obama declared that it was potentially healthy for the United States to have to interact economically on terms set for it by the rest of the world. Oh, my God. And later this week, he'll be revisiting his old stomping grounds in Indonesia. Spent his childhood there. Went to a madrasas there. It's like old home week, I guess. Again, he prefers to be president of the world. not of the United States, right?
Exactly.
President of the world, not of the United States. Unbelievable. Is Trickle Up Poverty one of the most illuminating books ever written? Well, I think it is. And today we've talked about my view is that the voters went over to the Republicans, not so much because they're in love with Republicans again, but it was to stop Obama's fast track to socialism. Speaking of which, on MichaelSavage.com, Al-Qaeda has stitched bombs inside dogs.
Oh, God.
They wanted to unleash deadly terror in the skies by sending a pair of kamikaze dogs onto a U.S.-bound plane, but the dogs died from the surgery.
Inhuman.
Authorities find a mass grave of kidnapped Mexican tourists. 18 bodies. Group of travelers. Kidnapped. Kidnapped from Acapulco, tourist city. Bound and thrown into a mass grave right south of our border. And Janet Napolitano refuses to protect us from the coming tide of gangs.
She has
the Houston Chronicle, college homecoming events canceled over nearby Mexican drug battles. Everyone knows it but Janet Napolitano. Nancy Pelosi will stay on as leader of the Democrats. Oh, my God.
They don't learn.
Over the weekend in San Francisco, a mob smashed cars and rioted over a cop's short sentence. The papers cheered them on. And Mayor Bloomberg of New York blasted Congress and the American people, saying that we shouldn't blame any of our problems on China while on a trip to Hong Kong yesterday. Oh, how sickening he is.
It's the same guy who was expanding his business empire in the Middle East, I think.
Toddler at risk of AIDS after dirty needle stick. Three-year-old Haley Rodriguez at risk for HIV infection and hepatitis after being pricked by a dirty needle at Montefiore Medical Center in New York City. Ay, poor kid.
God.
The other story is on MichaelSavage.com. Yemen hunts for American-born Al-Qaeda cleric dead or alive. AARP cites Obamacare and hiking employee costs. A drug smuggling ring. A kingfish in the drug smuggling world was killed in a gun battle. The home invasion monster was given a death sentence. I'm sure he'll appeal it.
No doubt.
An illegal alien has beat a woman age 77 with a crowbar. Jose Perez Gonzalez attacked the woman during a robbery of her Daly City, California home that left the woman blind and confined to an assisted living facility. Isn't diversity grand?
Jesus, they come here to work.
Energy chair filled by co-author of Light Bulb Ban, read that on MichaelSavage.com. Somali gangs ran sex ring in three states. Oh, I thought they all came here to work, the poor Somalis.
What kind of work?
29 people have been indicted in a sex trafficking ring in which Somali gangs in Minneapolis allegedly forced girls under 14 into prostitution. My blood's boiling from this country. The bastards, these Democrats, what they lie to us. Are they in cahoots with them? Are they paid off?
I wouldn't be surprised to find it out.
29 people have been indicted in a sex trafficking ring in which Somali gangs in Minneapolis and St. Paul allegedly forced girls under age 14 into prostitution in Minnesota, Tennessee, and Ohio. Can you believe this?
It's awful.
Forced them into prostitution so the defendants could get money, marijuana, or liquor. Oh, my Jesus. God. Young Somali or African-American girls were taken from place to place and forced to engage in sex acts with multiple people. Tell that to Janet Napolitano. How do we live in a country like this? Why don't you put them through a full body scan?
Yeah, I guess she's more interested in patting nuns down.
Unbelievable. This is the Savage Nation.
Savage.
What is Obama doing in India? Why has he brought 34 warships with him to Asia? And why is it costing us $200 million a day? Even Indian students are asking serious questions, more than we could say about the U.S. press corps.
A very warm welcome to you to India, sir.
Thank you
my
so
name
much.
Is, My name's Afshin Irani, and I'm from HR College of Commerce and Economics. We were the privileged college to host Mr. Otis Morse this January. So my question to you is, why is Pakistan so important an ally to America, so far as America has never called it a terrorist state?
And here's Obama's long-winded non-answer.
Well, no, it's a good question, and I must admit I was expecting it. Pakistan is an enormous country. It is a strategically important country, not just for the United States, but for the world. It is a country whose people have enormous potential. But it is also right now a country that within it has some of the extremist elements that we discussed in the first question. That's not unique to Pakistan, but obviously it exists in Pakistan.
But perhaps the president's refusal to call Pakistan a terrorist state has something to do with his view of jihad, which he was also asked about.
My name is Anna. I'm from St. Xavier's College. My question to you is, what is your take or opinion about jihad or jihadi? Whatever is your opinion? Like, what do you think of them?
The phrase jihad has a lot of meanings within Islam. And is subject to a lot of different interpretations. But I will say that, first, Islam is one of the world's great religions. And the more than a billion people who practice Islam, the overwhelming majority, view their obligations to their religion as ones that reaffirm peace and justice and fairness and tolerance. I think all of us recognize that this great religion, in the hands of a few extremists, has been distorted to justify violence towards innocent people that is never justified.
There you go. That's right. Just a few extremists. The real extremist is Obama, who thinks we have to meet the world on their terms, not on our own.
For most of my lifetime, I'll turn 50 next year. For most of my lifetime, the United States was such a dominant economic power. We were such a large market. You know, our industry, our technology, our manufacturing was so significant that we always met the rest of the world economically on our terms. And now, because of the incredible rise of India and China and Brazil and other countries, you know, the United States remains the largest economy and the largest market, but there's real competition out there. And that's potentially healthy.
But enough of this Chairman Obama, the accidental president. Here's a new one. My book is called Trickle Up Poverty, right? And I'm focusing on the economy. Now, one of the most corrupt officials in the entire government is the loudest liberal. Don't you always notice that? The loudest liberal is usually the dirtiest of the bunch. The one who screams the most about the poor, you help the poor, you help the poor. Listen to this story about Bonnie Frank. Now, I'm not mocking Bonnie Frank because of his lifestyle. I understand that Bonnie Frank has a dog, and it's not a husky, it's a hussy. And I understand that we've gone from huskies to hussies in one generation, and I don't blame him solely for that one. He can have a hussy as a dog just as I could have a poodle. But a story came out in the Boston Herald. If this doesn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt how corrupt this individual is, I'd like to know what would. What will change your psychotic mind to understand how rotten these people are? Here it is. Boston Herald. U.S. Rep. Bonnie Frank, immersed in one of the toughest political fights of his career, took a free private jet to the Virgin Islands courtesy of a Maine congresswoman's billionaire fiancé. Now, unto itself, that doesn't bother me. They all do this jet thing, even though it's illegal what he did, by the way. Okay? Somewhat, or let's say quasi-legal. And it doesn't look kosher, but wait, it gets worse. The fiancé upon whose jet he flew owned a hedge fund. He still does, by the way. Paloma Securities, a subsidiary of Mr. Sussman's Greenwich, Connecticut-based hedge fund, here it is, received $200 million
in 2009 as part of the $180 billion federal bailout of troubled insurance giant AIG record show. Now, if this is not criminal behavior and criminal activity, I'd like to know what is. Can anyone listening to this show who is out of a job or who lost his mortgage tell me that you will ever vote for a Democrat when you see that Bonnie Frank pushed $200 million of federal bailout money to a hedge fund billionaire? You're telling me that's the country you want to live in? And remember, Bonnie Frank voted for the bailout in October of 08. And he reported this trip on the guy's jet in required House financial filings and valued the flight at $1,500. Originally, Bonnie listed the trip vaguely as, quote, first-class round-trip travel by private aircraft in a congressional filing in May. Then in July, Bonnie Frank amended the report to show he traveled from Portland, Maine to the Virgin Islands. And he called the discrepancy a clerical error. Sussman is a huge Democratic campaign donor with homes in Maine and Connecticut, but he is living in St. John, the Virgin Islands. Now, why would a Democrat billionaire who has homes in Maine and Connecticut with a private jet live in St. John, the Virgin Islands? And why would Bonnie Frank steer $200 million of federal bailout money to a hedge fund? Ladies and gentlemen, we are living not in a banana republic, because that may be seen as a salacious statement, given that I am talking about Bonnie Frank. So I cannot say we are living in a banana republic in that regard. We are living in something even lower than a banana republic under these huskies. Hey, I liked it when it was a mean, nasty colonial country. That's the kind of England I like, because it was a fair, mean, nasty colonial country. When England had the right stuff, it was a country I admired. Once England went sissy on me and became girly men, they lost their empire. And that's what's happening to us. This country goes girly men on us, we're finished. That doesn't mean there won't be real macho guys who are tough. But when the nation loses its will to fight is when a nation falls apart. The media shows us as a non-virtuous nation. The media focuses on everything wrong with the country. The media says that the soldiers are the cowards and the so-called insurgents are the heroes. They're doing the same thing they did with the criminals in the streets of America for 40 years, making the cops evil and the killer the good person. They're sick in the head. It's not America that's sick. It's the liberals and the media that are mentally deranged.
Savage.
This is Michael Savage. I want you to know that freedom of speech is not free. Believe me, courageous radio stations like this one want your advertising dollars to pay their bills and be able to bring you my show and all the others you've come to depend on for the real truth. Talk radio in many ways is America's immune system, but it needs your booster shot. If you're a business, you need to put your money where your heart is. Advertise on this station. And here's the good news. According to Talkers Magazine, ads airing on talk stations like this one generate 2 to 3 times the response from customers than other radio formats would generate. Why? Because talk radio listeners support with their dollars the advertisers that support the radio shows that they love. If you're a business, any kind of business, I don't care if you're a roofer, a plumber, advertise in this station. If you're a listener, do business with the businesses that advertise on my show and others on this station. For more information on how you can buy ads in this station or my show, call 877-474-6605. Write it down, 877-474-6605.
Can you imagine a world without children? A world where children don't play, or dream, or imagine.
At St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, we're working every day to find cures for diseases that strike down children. Because we can't imagine a world without children. Can you?
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Call 1-800-931-0800 or log on to stjude.org.
Do you want to experience the full impact of the Michael Savage Show? Become a premium member and get Savage Live, Savage Archives, and the Savage Podcasts. Now you can take the Michael Savage Show anywhere and listen whenever and wherever you want. Get hooked up with the Michael Savage Show today. Go to www.talkradionetwork.com. That's talkradionetwork.com. Click on Savage's picture and sign up now.
Savage. The best network marketers in the world all desire three things from their new MLM opportunity. Products that dial into an untapped global phenomenon, to call on their MLM talents and get the good life fast, and to join early so they can quickly enjoy their dreams. Only top MLM professionals can join our new company now. Before we launch, we need top network marketers who can optimize the leads from our radio campaign to an audience of over 30 million. If you are a proven MLM professional who has earned six figures and achieved top ranks in other MLM companies, act now. Send a text message to 74499 and type MLM in the body of the message. These elite positions will go fast. Send a text message to 74499 and type MLM in the body of the message. Again, send a text to 74499 and type MLM in the message. Message and data rates may apply.
We've talked about the last election just last week and how the American people stood up and spoke out against Obama's Marxist policies very clearly. Joining us now is Representative Steve King from Iowa, who is doing what he can to slow the rise of socialism in the House of Representatives. Congressman King, welcome back to the Savage Nation. What do you think is happening now?
Well, I had been saying for, I suppose, a couple of months that this election, as it's coming up to the election, this election needed to be about this great big hole that President Obama had dug the nation into, and just envision the miners down in Chile that were down in the bottom of that deep mine. Obama was in a hole deeper than that. He still had the shovel in his hands, and he was still digging, furiously thinking that down there somewhere there must be a solution. And what happened is the American people rose up nationwide, not just for Congress, the House, and picking up Senate seats, but in our state legislatures and the governor's races, and they resoundingly repudiated President Obama's agenda and took the shovel out of his hands. So now he's going to be forced to stop digging, and we'll see now whether he goes down the path of being a committed ideologue or whether he can actually moderate his positions a little bit. But that's the message that I delivered going in. That's the message I'm hearing from the voters. And I'm now hearing across the district and the people I'm talking to, they're exhilarated by this change, and they are also looking to the work that started the morning after the election. We're going to see, I think, a lot more citizen involvement in the legislative process, as we've seen with the Tea Parties and 912 Project people.
Do you think Obama really got the message? I don't.
You know, I don't think so. I'd like to try to put up a little optimism there. But listening to his tone, he gave his press conference the day after the election, and I didn't get to hear it all, but he was on the screen a long, long time. And the part that I did hear, he said, well, now, you know, the new Congress is going to have to establish a consensus. Consensus was his code word for bipartisanship. President Obama was anything but bipartisan in the 2 years building up to this point. And I think that for him now to say to us, it's time to be bipartisan. No, we need to be principled. We need to be constitutionalists. We need to be conservative and fiscally responsible. And if to the extent that President Obama or the remaining Democrats in Congress can go down with that, then bipartisanship will be just fine. But otherwise, the principles that I've stood for a lifetime look like now they have a chance to at least be imprinted on the consciousness of America. Then a restraint will be there for President Obama. And then in 2 years, hopefully we'll have the legislative structure and a presidential structure so we can actually start to build things in a positive way again.
Well, obviously not all of them got the message. Nancy Pelosi has already said she's going to stay on as minority leader.
Well, as soon as I heard that, it hit me immediately. And I don't think I could have expressed it as well as they did by their sign, that the big red sign that was hanging out in the head of the NRCC headquarters in Washington, D.C., just a block or two blocks from the Capitol. That it said first the sign that hung out over the last few weeks has been "Fire Pelosi," and they changed the sign immediately to say "Hire Pelosi." Most Republicans see Nancy Pelosi as the embodiment of what's wrong with America, and the liberal activism, the progressive cause, the socialists, and you just can go right on down the line all the labels for the people that are counterculturalist and off the deep end on the left in America. Nancy Pelosi embodies all of that. She embodies everything that went wrong with America by driving her San Francisco agenda. And so if she's going to be back as minority leader, and apparently she has the votes for that because the best Democrats were the ones that were beaten because they represented marginal districts where they said we need to have a real Republican in there, not somebody. The blue dogs that were beaten because they voted for Nancy Pelosi and endorsed her and supported her agenda either explicitly or implicitly.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Now we have the situation where if Nancy Pelosi is the minority leader, then the embodiment of what's wrong with Obama's agenda will be there with Nancy Pelosi as the minority leader, and she's a perfect target. And I think that this diminishes the chances that President Obama could be reelected for a second term.
Well, the key phrase being thrown about now is gridlock. I think gridlock is the sign of a healthy democracy. What do you think of it?
Well, it looks to me like a majority of Americans would have been really pleased to have had gridlock over the last two, perhaps 4 years, rather than what we actually got. Nancy Pelosi presided over $5 trillion in accumulated deficit for the American budget. So if we could have had gridlock on...
We've talked about the last election just last week and how the American people stood up and spoke out against Obama's Marxist policies very clearly. Joining us now is Representative Steve King from Iowa, who is doing what he can to slow the rise of socialism in the House of Representatives. Congressman King, welcome back to the Savage Nation. What do you think is happening now?
Well, I had been saying for, I suppose, a couple of months that this election, as it's coming up to the election, this election needed to be about this great big hole that President Obama had dug the nation into, and just envision the miners down in Chile that were down in the bottom of that deep mine. Obama was in a hole deeper than that. He still had the shovel in his hands, and he was still digging, furiously thinking that down there somewhere there must be a solution. And what happened is the American people rose up nationwide, not just for Congress, the House, and picking up Senate seats, but in our state legislatures and the governor's races, and they resoundingly repudiated President Obama's agenda and took the shovel out of his hands. So now he's going to be forced to stop digging, and we'll see now whether he goes down the path of being a committed ideologue or whether he can actually moderate his positions a little bit. But that's the message that I delivered going in. That's the message I'm hearing from the voters. And I'm now hearing across the district and the people I'm talking to, they're exhilarated by this change, and they are also looking to the work that started the morning after the election. We're going to see, I think, a lot more citizen involvement in the legislative process, as we've seen with the Tea Parties and 912 Project people.
Do you think Obama really got the message? I don't.
You know, I don't think so. I'd like to try to put up a little optimism there. But listening to his tone, he gave his press conference the day after the election, and I didn't get to hear it all, but he was on the screen a long, long time. And the part that I did hear, he said, well, now, you know, the new Congress is going to have to establish a consensus. Consensus was his code word for bipartisanship. President Obama was anything but bipartisan in the 2 years building up to this point. And I think that for him now to say to us, it's time to be bipartisan, no, we need to be principled, we need to be constitutionalist, we need to be conservative and fiscally responsible. And if to the extent that President Obama or the remaining Democrats in Congress can go down with that, then bipartisanship will be just fine. But otherwise, the principles that I've stood for a lifetime look like now they have a chance to at least be imprinted on the consciousness of America, that a restraint will be there for President Obama. And then in 2 years, hopefully we'll have the legislative structure and a presidential structure so we can actually start to build things in a positive way again.
Well, obviously not all of them got the message. Nancy Pelosi has already said she's going to stay on as minority leader.
Well, as soon as I heard that, it hit me immediately. And I don't think I could have expressed it as well as they did by their sign, that the big red sign that was hanging out in the head of the NRCC headquarters in Washington, D.C., just a block or two blocks from the Capitol. That it said, first, the sign that hung out over the last few weeks has been, fire Pelosi. And they changed the sign immediately to say, hire Pelosi. Most Republicans see Nancy Pelosi as the embodiment of what's wrong with America. And the liberal activism, the progressive cause, the socialists, and you just can go right on down the line, all the labels for the people that are counterculturalists and off the deep end on the left in America. Nancy Pelosi embodies all of that. She embodies everything that went wrong with America by driving her San Francisco agenda. And so if she's going to be back as minority leader, and apparently she has the votes for that because the best Democrats were the ones that were beaten because they represented marginal districts where they said if we're going to, we need to have a real Republican in there, not somebody. The blue dogs that were beaten because they voted for Nancy Pelosi and endorsed her and supported her agenda either explicitly or implicitly.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Now we have the situation where if Nancy Pelosi is the minority leader, then the embodiment of what's wrong with Obama's agenda will be there with Nancy Pelosi as the minority leader, and she's a perfect target. And I think that this diminishes the chances that President Obama could be reelected for a second term.
Well, the key phrase being thrown about now is gridlock. I think gridlock is the sign of a healthy democracy. What do you think of it?
Well, it looks to me like a majority of Americans would have been really pleased to have had gridlock over the last two, perhaps 4 years, rather than what we actually got. Nancy Pelosi presided over $5 trillion in accumulated deficit for the American budget. So if we could have had gridlock on accumulation of deficit, that would have been a good thing. If we could have had gridlock on Obamacare, that would have been a good thing. Gridlock on financial reform, that would have been good. Gridlock on the House passing cap and tax. So gridlock's not the worst thing when you have the wrong people in power. And in the case with President Obama, gridlock, if he's determined to push forward, say, with amnesty or any of these other pet projects and agenda, would be a good thing. But I don't know that that will be the case. We'll see if we can. I'm going to be pushing to make the 2001 and the 03 tax cuts permanent rather than extend them out for a year or something that doesn't give some level of certainty. And if the president's willing to work on that, we can accomplish something that will not be gridlock. Meanwhile, it'll be his obstructionism to some degree, and I'm sure that he will be an obstructor when it comes to repealing Obamacare. So that will be gridlock, and I hope he's criticized for gridlocking the demand that the American people have is that Obamacare be repealed.
Many people feel that we're finally moving in the right direction, and I mean the right direction.
I get the feeling that the weight's been lifted and that we're now finally laid the foundation to move in the right direction. There's that component of it. There's a level of, let's say, what should I call it, cautious euphoria. In other words, euphoric that there's been that many seats picked up and that we now have laid this foundation. The caution comes from we've been here before. It wasn't a strong enough effort. And so I see the real constitutional conservatives in America wanting to support this new agenda that we're hearing articulated by most, you know, likely incoming Speaker John Boehner and incoming Majority Leader Eric Cantor and others. They want to support it. They want to be enthusiastic. And there's a component of it in restraint that is they want to make sure that the commitment is real, that the foundation of it is strong, and that it will be ongoing for years to come. And they understand, and the constitutional conservatives out there, the newly activists who are the conscience of America and the new majority makers, that they're going to have to keep the pressure up in Washington to get where they need to go.
Well, of course.
The members of Congress need the support of the American people. Some will go forward on principle without regard to political consequences. I have been labeled in that category. And others will be looking to sustain their seat in Congress and try to put up votes that they think will avoid criticism from their constituents. And so if that's the case, the pressure that comes will be good. But I think that it's, I'll call it restrained euphoria.
What can we expect to see in the next few years?
Well, of course, addressing the 01 and 03 tax cuts, that's the short term and the lame duck, and we need to be thinking about whether this lame duck session is going to be characterized by whether Nancy Pelosi and others will be contrite, and or will they be running the lame duck session out of spite? And I don't know. If they're going to put her back as a leader in their conference, then it might be spite rather than contrite. If they try to slip some things through that have to do with, say, any components of amnesty, there will be a great big fight. And any Congress that has been rejected by the American people is no longer the legitimate voice of Americans, and a lame duck session should not be used to move any significant pieces of legislation. It should be just used to clean up things that have to be cleaned up until the new Congress is seated. Then going forward into next year, the tax cuts, as I mentioned, looks like I have a reasonable chance to be the incoming chair of the Immigration Subcommittee. And on that, I expect there will be a rather aggressive agenda of hearings and fact-finding and laying down the foundation so that we can put some pieces of legislation perhaps off the floor of the House and send it over to the Senate. We'll have to cooperate with the Senate to some degree and see what kind of strategy will work there. That's something that'll be going on. And then there'll be a lot of investigations that need to take place.
Well, like what?
For example, the refusal of the Justice Department to enforce the voter intimidation of the new Black Panthers in Philadelphia, that's just an outrageous thing. They had a case that was made. They had convictions that were there. And Tom Perez, the Assistant Attorney General, in my view, directly lied to Congress, and he did so knowingly and willfully. Those things need to be brought forward. Acorn investigations are another. I would look at those two things in particular as investigations that need to take place. A third one would be Pigford Farms. That's the payoff to Black farmers that it looks like the administration has gone together to roll out about $2.3 billion altogether in payment to Black farmers who do not have to prove that they were discriminated against. They only have to sign an affidavit and file a document that says that they wanted to be a farmer and they believe they were discriminated against. So that's investigation number three. And I intend to be working forward on that, being on the Judiciary Committee and the Ag Committee. So that puts me in a position to drive the Pigford Farms investigation.
Congressman King, thanks again for being on the Savage Nation.
I'm always glad to do it, so keep pounding out there. I know people are listening. They let me know that. This is time to push this thing hard. We're moving the political center to the right together.
Two things are very clear here. We the people spoke out against the Obama Marxist agenda and their policies, and the left just doesn't want to accept it. They want to tell us about the election as something else, that it was a fluke. Look, we have to keep up the pressure. That is why I wrote Trickle Up Poverty. Read it.
Savage.
I like my mama's food, it's so good to me. Her meatballs have the spice that make them taste so nice. A little wine after we dine makes you feel so doggone fine. My mama's a cooking.
All right, welcome to a Savage. I'm focusing today on ethnic nutrition because many of us take pride in our ethnic background, as we should. And we eat what we think are ethnic meals, but in fact, I'm sorry to tell you, most of the ethnic meals that we're eating are not ethnic meals at all. Example, case in point, Italian food is not really Italian food that the average Italian ate, let's say, 150 years ago in Italy. The Italian diet then was quite sparse. It might have been a whole grain spaghetti or a whole grain noodle on the farm with some vegetables with very little animal protein. And perhaps some cheese products because they didn't kill the animal. But literally, they didn't slaughter the animal every time they ate a meal. And what you're eating is holiday meals three times a day, and you're getting the degenerative diseases associated with overly rich diets. It's the same with almost every other ethnic group on earth. And so you'd say, Jewish food. Oh, I'm going to go to the deli and have a corned beef sandwich with a pickle. And that's not Jewish food. That is 19th century holiday Polish food. Jewish food is Yemenite food. You want to really eat Jewish food? Eat a Yemenite diet. That is the southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula. And what the Yemenites eat is what the ancient Israelites probably ate. And that's why some of us wind up with diabetes and heart attacks so young, because we're eating diets that we're not adapted to. Did you know this? You say, oh, come on, how do you know that? How do you know that? How do you know any of this stuff? Oh, well, I trust my doctor. He tells me to eat what I want.
and just take Lipitor. And then if I get sick from any food, just take something to digest it. That's all. And if that doesn't work, they'll cut us open and remove something. All right, well, you could live that way if you want. You know what I'm saying? While the pig, the crow, the squid, and like creatures are forbidden by the Hebrew dietary laws, saturated fats, sucrose, and chemical additives are the unclean or forbidden foods in the etiology of internal health of rational man, I wrote. Page 138 of The Skeptical Nutritionist. I'm a genius. I really am. Boy, I was smart when I was young. That's really a good paragraph. Look at that one. Where the pig, the crow, the squid, and like creatures are forbidden by the Hebrew dietary laws, saturated fats, sucrose, and chemical additives are the unclean or forbidden in the etiology of internal health of rational man. That's really good stuff. And then I wrote, I support tradition, but urge my religious friends to eliminate dangerous components of their foods developed and introduced long after biblical laws were written. But it's like talking to yourself. You go to a Jewish group, they're sticking their... They're eating Stella d'Oro, a cake in their face every 2 minutes, a sweet. They wonder why they have diabetes, and they look so bad at 50, so many. I'm serious. They've lost all concept of diet. You can't live that way. It's impossible. Some can. It is true. Some people can eat anything. I call them nutritional rogues, by the way. These are the people who you say, oh, my grandfather lived to 104. You're full of crap, Savage, because he ate everything you just said he shouldn't eat, and he drank a bottle of scotch. I said, so he's a nutritional rogue. You try it. Get back to me when you're 50. See how long you last. Right? What else did I want to tell you about? I want to read your paragraph, introduction, why I am a skeptic. Oh, this is an interesting one. I quoted Galileo, who wrote, there is no scientific work that only one man can write. Now, that was written by Galileo in the Middle Ages. Listen to this, Al Gore, you schmuck. Al Gore, schmuck. And every other putz in the academic establishment who said that all the science is in on global warming. Schmucks, idiots. You don't even know what science means, you schmucks. Here's what Galileo wrote, putz. There is no scientific work that only one man can write, schmuck. Galileo wrote that, but Al Gore said all the science is in on global warming. And then the idiots in the media said all the science is in on global warming. They're heretics. We know the earth is flat. And anyone who says the earth is round is not a scientist, said Al Gore. And then the schmucks on MSNBC snickered and went, yeah. Introduction, why I am a skeptic. Food is such a personal thing, and how anybody can dare suggest diets for others continually shocks me. And repugnant cuisine is scarcely the road to health and long life, I wrote in 1983. One more paragraph. Let's see. Hey, oh, this is good. Now, there are fine books on becoming vegetarian. Some of my closest friends are vegetarians. That's a joke. Yet we must not seek to declare as an objective truth that the plant world holds our major key to longevity. It may be true that George Bernard Shaw, Tolstoy, Wagner, Shelley, Byron, Thoreau, and other illustrious figures were vegetable eaters, but so was Hitler. In fact, the German dictator's manic depressive mood swings and associated unexpected aggressive outbreaks might easily have been somewhat controlled with a good dose of high-quality protein and unrefined carbohydrates and with a steady intake of a good vitamin mineral supplement on a regular basis. Better, Hitler should have gnawed on a big leg of lamb once a day and had a glass of wine. The well-known photo of Hitler and Eva Braun at Berchtesgaden with the maniac passed out in an armchair after eating lunch is not an image the hypoglycemically attuned researcher is likely to forget, I wrote. Diet and behavior vary in too many people for us to look for a simple set of rules as our salvation from too intense swings of mood. So, I mean, I wrote some nice stuff. You know, Hitler was a vegetarian and didn't drink either. And he was always starving. He could never get enough of anything because he was always hungry, so he invaded one country after another and killed too many people. As I said, if he ate a leg of lamb and had a drink once in a while, the whole course of history would have been altered. It's absolutely true. The book was way ahead of its time, 1981, Macmillan Publishing, out of print. I still own the copyright, so don't rip it off. I think I'll reprint it now. A Strategy for Designing a Nutritional Profile. Tonight, it's a good book, not for sale. Not for sale. And I want to tell you that the word food fascism, the phrase, I think I coined it on page 6. Food fascism. I was against it then. The bookstores aligned with correct diets for the unmet masses. Social engineers, you see, I was against them. And then I wrote, food fascism, like other varieties of the social disease, requires lieutenants to proselytize. Not wishing to participate in any form of totalitarianism, I wrote, I intend not to dictate a correct diet for a fictional reader. Now, if only Michelle Obama knew that. She dictates to you what you should eat, and then she eats ice cream in Martha's Vineyard. And you're not supposed to notice that. She came back 8 pounds heavier. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. The king has no clothes. We're living through it. Every day we see the victory garden that's outside the White House, and then grow your vegetables and eat good, and you're not eating right. They're going to arrest you if your child's obese. Take them away from you. And every time they're on vacation, there they are in Dearborn, Michigan, and they're eating ice cream cones. What the heck? Not good for you to eat like that. Not healthy at all. You know, practice what you preach, my friend. This is the Savage Nation. With God's will and your listenership, I shall return. Savage.